Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 417 for March 23rd, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
The Angel's share is extremely high at Amrut here in Bangalore. It's about 10 to 12% per annum. So, like I keep mentioning, that the Angels are having a wonderful time in our warehouses.
It's been a long week with about 35 hours on airplanes round trip between Philadelphia and Bangalore, India, where I spent a couple of days visiting Amrut Distillery. I'll talk with Amrut Managing Director Rick Jagdale later on WhiskeyCast in depth, along with the calendar of events, your voice, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department, all on this week's episode of WhiskeyCast.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. There's been another distillery deal in Scotland. Billy Walker and his South African partners have added Glenglassaugh Distillery to their portfolio, joining Benriach and Glendronach. They bought Glenglassaugh from its Amsterdam-based owners for an undisclosed amount. I talked with Billy Walker just after the deal was announced.
You know, we kind of look at the landscape, Mark. We were interested. We've had ambitions to buy or grow the business and buy another single malt opportunity. And we looked around and we kind of figured that ones with heritage and history were pretty thin in the ground and who might be available. We liked Glenglassaugh. Locationally, it's just sensational. And it kind of fits quite nicely into our kind of geographical coordinates.
It's fairly near to you, but not too close, right?
It's new to us. It's right in the coast, in fact. And I was reminding Stuart today that, actually, Stuart, the next stop is Norway.
Now, is Stuart going to be staying on as part of this? And we're talking about
Stuart.
Well,
we'd like Stuart to stay on for as long as he feels comfortable to stay on, Mark. But I think even before our interest in the latter, Stuart probably had some other interesting challenges that he was setting himself. But let me tell you, Stuart Nicholson's done an absolutely terrific job with Glenglassaugh. He's with very limited resource and with very limited intellectual support from his shareholders, he's done just such a terrific job.
Do you think that they basically restarted this in order to sell it a few years later? Was that the goal, or was this what the plan was?
Actually, no, I don't. Mark, I really don't think that. But I think the problem is that they are they have a lot of interests, and maybe Scotland is quite far away, and maybe the business is just a little bit too kind of long-term for their kind of young, energetic minds.
But not for people who've been around it a long time like you, right?
Well, we kind of know the formula works. Very confident that we can do a decent job with Glenglassaugh because we, you know, the stock is now beginning to mature quite nicely and they've got a rich seam, a rich vein of fantastic vintage inventory.
What can we expect to see you guys do with Glenglassaugh in the coming years?
Well, I think the first thing you will see, Mark, is we will operate at somewhere near full capacity.
Which they've not been doing until now, right?
Well, they have not, in fact, nowhere near. But the reality is that in the industry, there is a kind of feeling that, of course, there is a shortage of mature inventory, but even more important, there may even be a shortage of capacity.
And that's industry-wide, not just at Glenglassaugh, not just at your distilleries, but that's all throughout, right?
No, that's a general statement. That's a general statement industry-wide. So to be able to acquire another single malt distillery with, I mean, some seriously nice heritage, we're so chuffed. We're really seriously chuffed this afternoon.
As of now, no changes in Glenglassaugh's distribution networks are expected. Last time around, our lead story was the move by Dewar's to enter the flavored whiskey market in the U.S., and at that time, the Scotch Whiskey Association was on record as supporting the plans for Dewar's Highlander Honey. A week later, the association is now expressing concerns over Highlander Honey, which adds locally grown honey to Dewar's white label blended scotch. Scottish laws ban the addition of flavorings to Scotch whiskey, but allow it for so-called spirit drinks. Highlander Honey does use the term spirit drink, but only on the rear label, and the front label only refers to Dewar's blended Scotch whiskey. In a statement, the association said the labeling and promotion for Highlander Honey needs to distinguish it more clearly from Scotch whiskey, and that the term spirit drink needs to be more conspicuous on the label. You'll find the labels for Highlander Honey in the news section of the WhiskeyCast website, and you can judge for yourself. So far, there's been no response from Dewar's to the SWA's concerns. Meanwhile, the biggest Scotch whiskey producer won't be following Dewar's on this one. Diageo's Dr. Nick Morgan told JustDrinks.com this week that the company has no plans for flavored versions of any of its Scotch brands. Of course, Diageo does offer flavored versions of some of its whiskeys from Bushmills and Crown Royal. In other news, Whiskey Magazine announced the winners of this year's World Whiskies Awards Thursday night on the eve of Whiskey Live London, along with the Icons of Whiskey Award winners. Let's start off with the World Whiskies Awards. Ardbeg Galileo was named the world's best single malt whiskey in blind judging, along with the best Islay single malt. Hibiki 21-year-old was named the world's best blended whiskey, George T. Stagg the world's best American whiskey, and the Mars Maltage 3 plus 25 from Japan the world's best blended malt. Bain's Cape Mountain from South Africa won best grain whiskey honors, and Master of Malt's 40-year-old Speyside whiskey liqueur took top honors for whiskey liqueurs. The complete list of winners is published in the latest issue of Whiskey Magazine, and I've posted a short list as well in the news section of the WhiskeyCast website. Turning now to the Icons of Whiskey Awards, last year the magazine decided to turn its Lifetime Achievement Awards into a Hall of Fame. This year's honorees, David Grant of William Grant & Sons, Jim Rutledge of Four Roses, Jimmy Russell of Wild Turkey, Richard Patterson of White & Mackay, and David Urquhart of Gordon & MacPhail. As for the icons, Irish Distillers was named Distiller of the Year. Beaumont's Eddie McCaffer was named Distillery Manager of the Year. Ardbeg's Jackie Thompson was named Visitor Center Manager of the Year. Ian McCallum of Morrison Beaumont Brand Ambassador of the Year. Master of Malt the Brand Innovator of the Year and Online Retailer of the Year. Binney's in Chicago was picked as Multiple Outlet Retailer of the Year, while the Celtic Whiskey Shop in Dublin was named Single Store Retailer of the Year. Finally, the Scotch Whiskey Experience was named the Visitor Attraction of the Year. By way of full disclosure, I served as a judge for the World Whiskies Awards and do vote in the selection of icons and Hall of Fame members. Meanwhile, the Ultimate Spirits Challenge handed out its own awards this week as well. The judging was held earlier this month in New York City, and Highland Park 25 received not only the Chairman's Trophy for single malt scotches, but a perfect score of 100 from the judges. Royal Salute 21 won the Chairman's Trophy for Best Blended Scotch, while the Hague Supreme 1627 12-year-old won for Best Blended Malt Scotch. Tullamore Dew 10-year-old received the Chairman's Trophy for Best Irish Single Malt, while Redbreast 15 won for Best Irish Pot Still Whiskey, and Jameson 18 won for Best Blended Irish Whiskey. Blanton's won for Best Bourbon, Knob Creek Rye for Best Rye Whiskey, and George Dickel No. 12 the Best Tennessee Whiskey. Caribou Crossing won the Chairman's Trophy for Best Canadian Whiskey, and Balcones won Texas Single Malt, won for Best American Whiskey. Once again, you'll find the link to a complete list of finalists and top scorers at the WhiskeyCast website. In other news, Heaven Hill is preparing to celebrate a milestone this week. They traditionally celebrate every 500,000th barrel that's filled, and Tuesday, Parker and Craig Beam will join the Shapira family in hammering in the bung on barrel number 6,500,000. Look for whiskey prices to go up in the UK starting this weekend. Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne has raised taxes on whiskey and other spirits by a little more than 5%. Taxes on wine are also going up, but Osborne threw struggling pub operators a bone by cutting taxes on beer by a penny a pint and eliminating the escalator clause that tied tax increases on beer to the rate of inflation. And as one might expect, the Scotch whiskey industry is not pleased. SWA Chief Executive Gavin Hewitt told reporters there's no justification for taxing spirits more heavily than beer. And finally, a couple of notes from fellow whiskey writers. Ulf Buxrud wrote an excellent book on Japanese whiskeys several years ago. He's now compiled a web guide to Ichiro Akuto's playing cards series of Japanese single malts. And Ian Buxton and his wife are selling their home near Pitlochry. What makes this interesting is that the home is the former manager's house at the old Tom DeCole distillery, which was closed back in 1878. And the deal includes the old distillery buildings. Ian's realtor is suggesting that those buildings could become the home for a new craft distillery under the right ownership. You'll find links for both at the WhiskeyCast website, and that's also where you'll find news updates all week long. But for now, that's the week's news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Introducing Glenmorangie Cask Masters Projects. Keep an eye on our Glenmorangie USA Facebook page for more details of this exciting project.
Time now for Your Voice, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. Heard from Mickey Hammond in Georgia this week. He was having problems using the WhiskeyCast smartphone app, and he's not alone. That app gets most of its data from the WhiskeyCast website, and our transition to the new site changed the way we organize all of that data. We're working with our app ninjas now on an update that will make many of the functions of the new site available. But until then, you can also point your phone's web browser to the WhiskeyCast website. It's designed to work well with mobile phones, too. I'll have more on this later on, but a photo I posted on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page from my visit to Amrut this week got a lot of people fired up. The picture was from Amrut's small on-site cooperage and shows a distillery worker kneeling next to a cask and turning it while it's being recharged with a gas flamethrower. It had some people expressing concerns about the worker's safety, but Graham Harvey, one of the owners of the Crag and Mill restaurant in Speyside, had a question about the photo itself. He was wondering what happens when the bunghole comes around. I had to look at it on a larger display when I got home, but that photo clearly shows what happens. Look for the big ball of flame on the left side. That's the flame coming out of the bunghole. And finally, I had a couple of beers the other night in Bangalore with Hemanth Rao, one of our longtime listeners, and he has a question that we need your help with. His relatives in the Seattle area will be visiting India later this year, and he wants to have them bring some whiskeys over for him. He asked me to recommend some good whiskey shops in Seattle. However, Washington switched over last year from state-run liquor stores to privately run ones. I haven't been in Seattle since the switch, so I don't know any I can personally recommend. If you live in the Seattle area and can share some suggestions, please post them on the Your Voice section of the WhiskeyCast website. You can also post your own questions or comments there, too. Just look for Your Voice in the pub section. Your Voice is brought to you this week by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Just a few more days to go until Whiskey Live New York, coming up April 3rd at Chelsea Piers in Manhattan. You'll be able to choose from more than 200 different whiskeys that will be poured that night, including some making their U.S. debuts that evening. The folks from the Flatiron Room in New York City will be staffing the cocktail lounge that night, and there'll be a special bourbon-themed buffet, too. We'll be recording April's episode of WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings that night, and if you play your cards right, you might just wind up on the tasting panel. Now, you can get a 15% discount on tickets when you use the promo code WhiskeyCast, all lowercase letters, or just CAST, again, all lowercase, at the Whiskey Live website. That's whiskeylive.com. Whiskey Live New York is April 3rd at Chelsea Piers in New York City. This message is brought to you by Whiskey Live New York. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. The next few weeks will be busy ones. The Flatiron Room in New York City will have a bourbon tasting on the 26th with at least one Pappy Van Winkle on the menu. Whiskey Live Perth will be on the 27th in Perth, Australia. The Good Spirits Company in Glasgow, Scotland will have a tasting of World Whiskies on the 28th. Chip Tate of Balcones Distillery will lead a class on whiskey blending at the Astor Center in New York City April 4th. The Austrian Whiskey and Spirits Festival is April 5th in Linz, Austria. The Whiskies of the World Expo will be on the 6th of April in San Francisco, along with the Brighton Whiskey Fest in Brighton, England. And the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Australian chapter will hold a series of tastings in New Zealand the week of April 8th. You can find all of the details on the calendar of events page at the WhiskeyCast website. In fact, you'll find events on every continent except Antarctica on the calendar. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at the Laphroaig website, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Barry Crockett, master distiller. Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
The pot still category is receiving so much attention nowadays. I think what we will see as time progresses is that the single pot still category will indeed resume its rightful place at the very top end of the whiskies of the world. And of course, this is only correct given that Irish whiskey has had world recognition for not just decades, but you could say for centuries. And Redbreast is at the forefront of that.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Woodford Reserve. As I mentioned earlier, it's been a long week with 17,000 miles in the air round trip between Philadelphia and Bangalore. Last November, in episode 396, Amrut Distilleries Managing Director Rick Jagdale met me in Philadelphia for an interview, which you can hear at the WhiskeyCast website. He and Amrut's global sales manager, Ashok Chakalingham, who you've heard on WhiskeyCast many times over the years, invited me then to visit the distillery in Bangalore as their guest. I spent a couple of days this week at the distillery, and you'll be able to experience more of my visit on an upcoming episode of WhiskeyCast HD. Now, back in November, Rick and I talked about Amrut's history, dating back to when his grandfather started the distillery in 1948, just a year after India won its independence from Great Britain. This week, we sat down in the distillery manager's office to catch up and get some of the questions that you sent in answered.
A lot's changed since we sat down back in November, as far as Amrut is concerned. You have multiple new releases coming out, and things have gotten fairly interesting around here. Well, let's first start off with the oldest Amrut yet that you haven't had a chance to really talk about much because it's still on the boat in many cases, right?
Yes.
And it's really appropriate because it's called Greedy Angels in reference to the evaporation around here, right?
Yeah. Yes, Mark. The name was coined by Ashok again. Greedy Angels because the angel's share is extremely high at Amrut here in Bangalore. It's about 10 to 12% per annum. So, like I keep mentioning, that the angels are having a wonderful time in our warehouses. But at the same time, they bless us with excellent whiskey. And yeah, Greedy Angels is the oldest Amrut bottled ever at 8.5 years. We have lost close to about 70% of the whiskey in the farm, in just as the angel share, as evaporation losses. So, yes, I think that's a pretty high percentage to lose just as the angel share.
What markets will this be available in and how soon?
It will be available in the United States. There are just 160 bottles, Mr. Sundar?
132
bottles world over. So, virtually, I mean, all our distributors are scrambling for the stock, and virtually we found it very difficult to ration it out. So, yes, there are a few couple of bottles which are made available for the United States, a few bottles for the European Union, and a few bottles for Canada. So that's probably even Stevens, we're splitting it. So I guess 40 each for each country.
And that reflects your three main export markets right now, the U.S., Canada, and the European Union. Let's talk about those export sales, because those markets will also be getting a new Amrut 100 too as well, right?
Indeed, yes. All these three markets that you mentioned will be getting Amrut 100 as well. The Amrut 100 expression is only in the peated variant that we have launched. It's made from 100% peated malted barley. It's obviously matured for 5 years plus. And it's bottled at 100 British proof, which is 57.1%, bottled in a 100 centiliter bottle. And these are the specialities of Amrut 100. So that's why it's called 100. Everything got to do with this is 100.
And while I was here, you're bottling up another batch of Porto Novo to go to the UK this time, right?
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, this is the third bottling of the Amrut Porto Novo, which will be shipped to the UK. And from there on, again, we have to ration it out globally. So that's the idea.
Tell me about the priorities you're placing in terms of your export markets. You're in about 22 countries now, right? Mm-hmm. Where are you focusing on trying to spread Amrut around, or are you going to start focusing more towards India and your home market here where it hasn't always been available?
Our focus in the next couple of years would definitely be the United States first, and then India. Reason being, the United States and Canada, United States and Canada, because we are only present in a few states or provinces as in the case of Canada. So we'd like to be available in as many states and provinces in each of those respective countries. And obviously India. India is a huge market. We are only present in the state of Karnataka, that is the city of Bangalore, which is the capital. And we would love to make Amrut available in at least major cities like Chandigarh, Delhi, Bombay, which is Mumbai, Madras, and Hyderabad, for sure, yes.
And you've agreed to take some questions from WhiskeyCast listeners that have been submitted in via Facebook and through Twitter as well. And I want to pull one of those questions up here because this links right back to a question that one of our listeners had asked about. Fine Spirits in Cooper City, Florida, asked this question specifically. He's curious about how you market in India, but also wants to know more about the Amrut Legends release. So let's first of all talk about how you market in India, given that you have 25 states with almost total control over their own liquor availability and their own set of taxes and own set of structures, because it really does pose some interesting challenges for you, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, India, with its own federal nature of alcohol policy, it's like dealing with virtually 25 different countries, to be honest. Because, for example, let's say the immediate priority for us this year would be to enter Bombay. Now, Bombay or Mumbai is the capital of the state of Maharashtra, which is the neighboring state to Bangalore, that's Karnataka. And there are certain entry restrictions there wherein you have to fill out a form which costs about ₹1 million to fill out the form. It's called a K form. There are loads of label registrations within the state. And the duty structures are totally different. For example, a bottle of let's talk about the Amrut Fusion, retails in my state, Karnataka, Bangalore, at about ₹2,400, which is roughly about $50 a bottle. But the same Fusion will be available in say, Mumbai, that's Maharashtra, for about ₹3,500, which is roughly about $65. So there's a 30% increase straight away. So the challenges are definitely there. But that's how the market is for everybody. And the sheer diversity in the excise policies within the country itself poses a challenge, not only for Amrut, but for many spirits manufacturers within the country and abroad as well.
And you also have to deal with different proof levels or ABV levels in different states as well. I think you told me before that you'd have to do three separate versions of Fusion,
yes,
to make it available in India, right?
Oh, yes, indeed. It's a state like Karnataka, that's where Bangalore is the capital, has a very liberal policy. The government, with its more liberal policies, has allowed us to bottle the Fusion at 46% for the domestic market. Obviously, Fusion world over, apart from India, is bottled at 50%. But the same Fusion, the product profile remaining the same, is bottled at 42.8%. Nothing more for the state of Maharashtra, because that's the rule. That's the law. The law there states that you can't sell anything that is bottled above 42.8% alcoholic proof. So Fusion technically would be in three alcoholic strengths. That is 50% for the overseas market, as that's export for India. 46% for the state where I come from, Bangalore, Karnataka, Bangalore, and rest of India, it will be 42.8%.
And let's answer the other question about Amrit Legends. What is that one, and when will it be coming out?
Well, Amrit Legends, it's a good question, Mark. Amrit Legends, it's still in the making, actually. We have both Ashok, myself, Surinder, Mr. Mep, and I've given it a thought. Probably it would come out next year. We're looking at different variations and versions of that. So it's still at a nascent stage, Amrit Legends.
While I've been here, it's been very dry, and monsoon season is still a couple of months away, but I know that you've also been worried about the drought here, as well as our friends back in the States in the bourbon country have been worried about drought there affecting corn crops last year and possibly into this year as well. Tell me about how the drought's affecting you, since you technically have to truck your water from a water supply that you own several miles away, and you're depending on that water supply for not only your single malt, but all of your other production, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, our distillery needs close to about 200,000 liters of water every day. So, yes, we have, we resort to deep well water resource, which is about 7 to 8 kilometers from here. And we have our own trucks, water tankers that cart the water up and down. Yes, it's going to be a major challenge, especially in view of the monsoon, which has failed last year, and the drastically depleting water levels that we see in and around the distillery. Getting water will be a major, major challenge in the coming months, especially when summer is just around the corner.
And you have to share some of that water with the other Jagdale family enterprises, the orchards and the vineyards and some of the agricultural concerns around here as well, right?
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, yeah. We do have some farming interests where the water is currently available, but the main resource or the main area where water is utilized is mainly for the distillery.
Let's turn to another listener question now. Mila Kambuel, and I'm probably butchering that name, asked a question on Facebook about her club ordering Amrit for a tasting recently and found rust in the tins, or inside the tin and on the bottle from the canisters that you used to use, which you're phasing out as well. So we'll address that in a second. And I know we talked about this earlier, and you told me that was only the second time you'd seen this happen, or that you've heard about this happening. Explain how you try to protect that, because I know you're using locally sourced steel for the canisters. So I know that you did take some steps to prevent any kind of oxidation inside the canisters, but explain what you did and how this could have happened and what steps you're doing to make sure that it doesn't happen in the future.
See, the main reason why the rusting happens, especially at the upper part of the canister, is mainly because the tin that is used to fabricate the canisters, maybe certain areas don't get the exact coat of anti-rust elements. So lacquering is the right word. So at times it does happen. This is only the second time in about 10 years that we have come to hear about this. So we are taking care at the supplier level to ensure that this doesn't happen again. So stricter quality control measures and standards have been already set in place, and we are quite confident that this won't repeat again.
And with switching to cardboard boxes, if you get rust inside a cardboard box, you have an even bigger problem on your hands, right?
Well, I don't think we have a rust issue on the cardboard boxes. Hopefully,
I'm being facetious, of course.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Also, I want to give credit to Joanne McGinnis because she had asked about the Angel's Share, which you addressed earlier, being about 11 to 12% a year. One of the other questions that we had from listeners in the past is, we've already addressed the one about how you market within India, but let's talk now about your export sales, because you've focused on those key markets, and you said you talked about the U.S. and also dealing with trying to focus on your domestic market here in India. I'm presuming that that implies that while you're not obviously cutting back in Europe, you are at least trying to reduce some exposure, and I'm assuming that's because of the Eurozone crisis, at least in terms of reducing your exposure to any potential issues there, right?
Well, the Eurozone crisis is definitely a major concern for us at the moment. Though sales, especially in certain markets, certain countries within the Eurozone have shown a degrowth for us, especially last year, most of them have held on to the same volume that they did the previous year. We are concerned about what's going to happen in the future, but I guess since now we are going to make Amruth available in rest of the countries world over, so probably any negative impact coming out of the Eurozone should probably be able to withstand that, I guess.
How's the domestic market holding up? Since we're talking about the economy, there have been issues here as well. Where are you strong? Where are you weak in terms of your sales domestically, not only for the single malt Amrut, but for your other spirits as well?
See, the primary thing, Mark, is that we are a very regional company. Like I'd mentioned earlier, the sheer federal nature of the liquor policy within India makes it that much difficult for a regional player like us to be available pan-India. We are available, and Amrut is sold pan-India. Amrut, in a sense, different portfolios of rum, brandy, gin, vodka that we do, and whiskey, blended whiskeys in India that we do, are sold through a single pan-India channel, and that's the canteen stores department, which is basically caters to the Indian Armed Forces. So coming to the civilian sector, being regional, we are currently present in 3 states in South India, and like I said, our next definitely sort of a growth in the domestic market on the luxury malts and spirits sector would be Maharashtra, and that would be Bombay.
And let's go back to export for a second. We have a question from Robert Mark. He wants to know when the cask strength will be widely available in the U.S. He enjoyed it when he was living in Europe, but he can only find the 40% ABV expressions in the U.S. Will the cask strength Amrut be making it over to the U.S. anytime soon?
Well, the cask strength Amrut, the reason why we had to cut back globally 2 years ago is mainly because of the increased demand in fusion and the standard single malt that we produced, which was very, very good sign for us. But unfortunately, we had to withdraw the cask strength standard and the peated variants of the market because simply we couldn't cater to the demand. So I presume and I feel that probably October this year, we would probably reintroduce the standard cask strength back into the global market, I guess, yeah. And in the U.S., it would probably be there probably by Christmas, I guess.
So we'll keep an eye out for that later on this year.
Yeah.
Next question is from Pierre Wader, I believe, and he wants to hear about the importance to Amrut of using Indian-grown barley instead of relying on barley that's imported from Europe, except for what you do import from Scotland for peated use, because there's no place in India, obviously, to get peat. Mm-hmm. So you do have to rely on some imported barley from Scotland. How critical is it to you to have Indian-grown barley for your product?
Well, it's very critical because the standard single malt that we produce is made from 100% malted Indian barley. And barley is grown in the northwestern states of India, like Punjab, Rajasthan, certain parts of Haryana, closer to Delhi. So it's basically a winter crop, and winters in North India can be pretty harsh. We had a very long winter this time, so which is more used where barley can be grown. So yes, our dependence on the Indian barley has been there and will continue to be there because we want to keep that USP that it's made from 100% malted Indian barley. And that's mainly the reason.
And as you point out, those farms are located in the far north of India, up near the Himalayas. You're in Bangalore, which is far to the south. Let's talk about fuel prices. How's that affecting you in terms of getting all that barley trucked down here? Because it's a pretty good haul to have barley shipped down from up north, right?
Oh, yes, indeed, Mark. We have seen barley prices, malted barley prices, shoot up over the past 2 years by close to about 25-30%, and this has got to do with the perpetual increase in fuel prices. So yes, it's having an impact on our raw material cost, definitely is.
And we have another question now from Blair Bowman. He wants to know more about your maturation and how the temperature here, and as we're sitting here today, it's about 90 degrees Fahrenheit. in the upper 30s or so, in the mid 30 degrees range Celsius outside. How does the temperature affect your maturation? I know we've been talking about this over the last couple of days, and the feeling here is that it's not as much the temperature as the altitude, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, there are three critical factors which attribute the very high angel share that is that we have been experiencing here at Amrut. A is the altitude. Bangalore is at about 900 feet, which is close to about 2,800, 3,000 feet above sea level. So the altitude is playing a very critical factor. The second factor is the temperature. It's very warm, as you said, 35 degrees is already March. And the humidity. The temperature, the average humidity in our warehouses during summer is about 80-85%, but in winter can drop to about 60-65%. And this fluctuation in humidity increases the losses that we have been experiencing. Because less the humidity, greater are the losses. Higher the humidity, lesser are the losses. So it's inversely proportional to each other. So yes, the loss, the angel share is very high.
And as you pointed out earlier, it's about 11 to 12% a year. But that's why with this increase in the humidity and with the high temperatures, that's why your whiskey matures in realistically 4 to 5 years as compared to much older for scotches and bourbons, and why the oldest you've ever been able to release is Greedy Angels at 8.5, right?
Indeed, yes. That's one of the reasons why, though we would love to mature more than 12, 15 years, unfortunately, there won't be anything left in the barrel for us to sell. So it's that's the reason.
But you tried something called Two Continents to try to minimize that, where it was fully matured here for 4 to 5 years, and then you sent those casks to some place in Europe that's never been publicly disclosed to spend some time in Europe under cooler conditions and less humid conditions. Tell me how that worked out.
Oh, well, Two Continents has worked out really well. It's matured in India for about 2 to 3 years, and then it's sent to Europe, where it spends another a period of equal number of years, 2.5 to 3 years, and then it's ready for bottling. And it's bottled in Europe. So that's why it's different, it's unique.
But it actually had, because of those different climate conditions, it was able to mature a bit longer.
Oh, yes. Because the losses that we have experienced there is about less than 2%. Whereas here is about 10 to 12%. So it produces, the whiskey undergoes a different metamorphosis over there. So you get a better product at the end of the day.
I'm sort of to blame for this one. We need to explain this a little bit. The photo that I posted on our WhiskeyCast Facebook page of your recharring site with the guys recharring a barrel while I was here. In the photo, it looks like that young man that's cranking the barrel is sitting right next to the open mouth of the barrel. In point of fact, we need to address that that's a camera angle issue, and he's really actually about 2 to 3 feet behind there, right? In a much safer spot.
Oh, yes. He is a little bit further back, but we have taken up certain safety issues as far as that is concerned, and this is the recharge facility that we have at our distillery will definitely be undergoing a change wherein it'll be mechanized to a certain extent in the coming months from now. So yes, you'll find a differently far more improved and more mechanized version of that.
And I just want to point out that it was for safety reasons. So people were expressing concern about that young man's safety being there. So we talked about it earlier today about possibly putting that on a motor.
Yes, yes.
And some sort of motor system to crank that around. I wanted to point that out just so that we could correct it, because I know there are some people who were concerned about it.
Oh, yes, it's because the angle of the shot was makes you feel as if he's very close to the flames and fire, but that's not the case. He's virtually about a couple of feet at least away from that. So, but having said that, we have to take more caution and care to see that we bring in a fair bit of mechanization at that part of the at that end of the operational production cycle, so we have to do that.
And we should point out this is the only facility of its kind anywhere in India, because nobody else is maturing whiskey on site using barrels and having to recuper them and rechar them and all. So this was one of those things that, as we've talked about over the last couple of days here, was a process that was invented here. You guys came up with this 20, 30 years ago on your own, and that was the way things were always done, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, ours is probably the only distillery which has a dechar and rechar facility on the distillery site. So that's something different that we have to offer.
But it is also something unique because most of the locally made whiskey here and locally made spirit is actually not matured in oak, but you guys are one of the few distilleries that are maturing in oak and leaving it here. Are you seeing much more competition now that you have sort of set the pace? Because as we've pointed out before, Amrit was the first Indian single malt whiskey. And I know that other competitors have tried to come in and join the field since then. But are you seeing more competition, at least in the states where you are selling?
Yes. I mean, there will be competition coming in from other distillers within India, having seen that Amrit has already established a niche within the international market for malt whiskies produced from the subcontinent. We are prepared, and we also realize that there are a couple of distillers that who will probably follow suit pretty soon, I guess.
One last question. We're still waiting for the final announcement, but it appears that the deal between Diageo and United Spirits looks like it's going to happen soon. Yeah. In the next few weeks. What does that mean for companies like Amrit and the rest of the market when it appears that United Spirits, the Vijay Mallya-owned company, will have finally some sound financial footing and be able to compete even more than it does already now in the market and have some Diageo backing behind it? What does that mean for you guys?
We see it as an opportunity because... as we understand, once the deal is through and Diageo has a more controlling stake within United Spirits, probably some of the brands that are in the economy and the lower range, probably they may either hive off the brands or they may discontinue it because they are not contributing as much as what Diageo probably would be expecting. Having said that, well, the whole, I feel that the entire Indian alcoholic beverage industry should be prepared for some major changes, especially on the marketing front of the alcohol beverage industry. There will be some changes, and everybody must keep an open mind and see. And if there are opportunities that which needs to be got looked into, we must grab that opportunity, I guess, if it comes along.
Because after all, this is your home market and it's the bread and butter. The rest of us around the world think of you as a single malt,
yes.
But the bread and butter is the whiskies and the spirits that you make here at home.
Yes, the bread and butter is the local domestic whiskies, brandies, rums and gins that we do, and vodka that we do here in India. We see a great potential in those brands as well in the coming years, for sure.
By the way, there is another edition of Two Continents maturing quietly somewhere in Europe at an undisclosed location. As I said earlier, I'll have more from Bangalore on an upcoming episode of WhiskeyCast HD, and once again I need to disclose that Amrit covered my expenses for making the long trip to India. That's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth, brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Discover Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, uniquely matured in two separate new white oak barrels, the second deeply toasted and lightly charred for a more complex dimensional flavor. Find out more at WoodfordReserve.com. Be double sure. Drink responsibly. Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume, Woodford Reserve Distillery, Versailles, Kentucky. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with one of the whiskeys Rick Jagdale and I discussed. Greedy Angels is the oldest Amrit yet at more than 8 years old, and it's bottled at 50% ABV. It'll be available in very limited amounts later this spring. The nose is smooth with a caramel cola note, mild cinnamon and nutmeg spices, and a hint of lemon. The taste, though, is thick and spicy with intense cinnamon and curry powder spices that build quickly and stick to the tongue. Hints of fresh orange, honey, and coconut balance the spiciness. The finish is long and consistent as the notes from the taste fade slowly away. I'm scoring Amrit's Greedy Angels a 92. Our lead story this week was the sale of Glenglassaugh Distillery to the owners of Benriach and Glendronach, and I had a sample of 36-year-old Glenglassaugh sitting on my tasting table, just waiting for me to get around to it. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is warm and oaky with a touch of smokiness, honey, dried fruits, and toffee. The taste is peppery and intense with ginger, Christmas cake, and a hint of lemon. And the finish is dry and short with lemon and pepper notes fading away slowly. I'm scoring the Glenglassaugh 36-year-old an 86. And finally, I mentioned a new whiskey from Cleveland last week. Cleveland Bourbon Whiskey uses a secret process that is said to accelerate the maturation of six-month-old bourbon to make it look and taste like a much older bourbon, using high pressure to force the whiskey through charred oak staves and extract the same compounds and flavors that would be achieved over time. At least that's what the distiller claims. It's bottled at 50% ABV, and to be fair, Cleveland Bourbon does have the color of a much older bourbon, but that's where the similarities end. The nose is very tannic, with caramel, vanilla, oak, and a touch of molasses. The taste is extremely tannic and resinous, with pepper, molasses, and a very sharp bite. And the finish is dry and tannic, with a molasses touch and a hint of sawdust. It's very much out of balance, and in my opinion, barely drinkable. While this process, whatever it is since it's being kept secret, succeeds in extracting compounds from the wood, it ignores the fact that what makes whiskey good is the chemical reactions over time between the spirit, the wood, and the air that break those compounds down into flavors. As I said last week, there's no substitute for time. Now, Cleveland, the city, has taken a lot of abuse over the years, and I will not pile on here. However, Cleveland Bourbon Whiskey only rates a 60 in my book, and while that's the lowest score I've ever given to a whiskey, I think I'm being generous. I've added these tasting notes to the WhiskeyCast website, along with the other whiskeys I tasted this week, the McAllen Flask Edition and Compass Box Eleuthera. You'll find my searchable tasting notes for nearly 950 whiskeys at our new website. That's also where you'll find news updates all week long, the calendar of events with more than 200 events around the world, the new Your Voice section, and of course a searchable archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening. Thank you.